analyze, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The body's filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. 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 Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome to Freedom Loves Company. Freedom Loves Company airs every Sunday night from 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and midnight to 2 a.m. GMT. My name is John Shuck. My website is johnshuck.com, johnshuck.com. Also, progressivespirit.com. .net. There you can find podcasts after these shows air live. They're put on podcasts. They're sent to the Pacifica Radio Network and available for any radio station. They are radio ready. Today is Sunday, September 5th, 2021. And earlier this afternoon, I recorded an interview with Dr. Peter McCullough. And that is what we're going to hear right now during this first hour. Welcome to Freedom Loves Company. My name is John Shuck. You can find Freedom Loves Company podcasts on johnshuck.com or progressivespirit.net. My guest is Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. Peter McCullough is an internist, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and academic medical practice in Dallas, Texas. He maintains ABIM certification in internal medicine and cardiovascular diseases. He practices both internal medicines, including the management of common infectious diseases, as well as the cardiovascular complications of both the viral infection and the injuries developing after the COVID-19 vaccine. Since the outset of the pandemic, Dr. McCullough has been a leader in the medical response to the COVID-19 disaster and has published Pathophysiological Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 Infection, the first synthesis of sequenced multi-drug treatment of ambulatory patients infected with SARS-CoV-2 in the American Journal of Medicine and subsequently updated in reviews in cardiovascular medicine. He has 46 peer-reviewed publications on the infection and has commented extensively on the medical response to the COVID-19 crisis in The Hill and on Fox News Channel. On November 19th, 2020, Dr. McCullough testified in the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs and throughout to 2021 in the Texas Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, Colorado General Assembly, and New Hampshire Senate concerning many aspects of the pandemic response. Dr. McCullough has had one full year of dedicated academic and clinical efforts in combating the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and in doing so, has reviewed thousands of reports, participated in scientific congresses, group discussions, press releases, and has been considered among the world's experts on COVID-19. He also hosts the McCullough Report on the America Out Loud radio network. He has graciously agreed to be with me today to go over some basic questions about this COVID and the treatment plan. So welcome, Dr. McCullough, to Freedom Loves Company.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to start off with the basic question. What is COVID-19 and does it exist? I mean, I know I've had people who've claimed that this is largely a media manipulation. And so you're the expert. So tell me, what is this COVID-19?
Well, as you introduced me, I'm a practicing doctor. So I see and examine patients every day. In fact, I just made a visit to see a patient this afternoon with COVID-19. And I'm here to tell you it's a real illness. COVID-19 is the name of the syndrome, the clinical syndrome. And the virus is SARS-CoV-2, and it's the second of the first one was called SARS-CoV-1, which caused the SARS epidemic 17 years ago. SARS-CoV-2 is a coronavirus, and this one causes a particularly deadly syndrome, COVID-19.
So, well, that's the question then. As you said, you've treated patients with COVID-19. What is distinctive about it? How do you know someone has COVID-19?
There's several distinctive features. One is it does start out much like a cold, but unlike many people who get an upper respiratory tract infection get 2 to 3 or 4 days of a sore throat, then they get nasal congestion. With COVID-19, it's different. COVID-19 usually leads with nasal congestion, loss of taste and smell, headache, fever, and body aches. And a sore throat is a pretty minimal feature of COVID-19. So it starts out differently. I think one can actually tell the difference between the two. The other feature of COVID-19, which is different than a typical head cold, is that it lasts a long time. The typical person with COVID-19 can go weeks with this illness. The average person getting hospitalized is typically 2 to 4 weeks into the illness before they succumb to hospitalization. And I can tell you biologically what's unique is that like other infections, there is a viral replication phase. But with this one, it trips off patterns of inflammation called cytokine storm. And that is closely linked to thrombosis or blood clotting. The virus damages the inside of blood vessels, causes red blood cells to adhere to one another, and trips off a unique type of blood clotting or thrombosis. The laboratory panel that the doctors see is unique with COVID-19. Interestingly, the lymphocyte count is depressed as opposed to being elevated. We see an elevation in a unique blood clotting parameter called D-dimer. And then on X-ray or CT scan, we see a distinctive pattern. It's called COVID pneumonia. It's really not pneumonia. What we know now from autopsy studies is that the X-ray appearance and the CT appearance likely reflects microthrombosis or small blood clots in the lungs.
So how infectious and how lethal is COVID-19?
Well, the infectivity is typically assessed with each new variant of the virus using cell models where a human immortal cell in a test tube is then exposed to the virus, and there's calculations of how easily the virus attacks the cell. And so infectivity can be inferred from these in vitro studies. But we can also calculate from human studies in terms of estimates of spread and how the epidemic curve develops over time. There's epidemiologic measures of this. And as a general principle, this virus is more contagious than the common cold, more contagious than SARS-CoV-1. And with each successive mutation, it appears to become even more contagious.
And so it's more contagious, but how what's the lethality rate?
The lethality rate, or even if we looked at the composite endpoint of hospitalization and death, and I think that's the two important endpoints here. I think if everyone knew that they would get this, but they could be managed at home and they wouldn't be hospitalized or die, I think the whole world's anxiety level would go down. It's really the specter of becoming hospitalized or dying that drives much of the fear of COVID-19 and this pandemic. What we know is that composite is tightly related to age. It's tightly related to multiple medical problems. And it also is related to the presentation of severe symptoms. So in general, individuals over age 50, and once we start adding non-medical problems like obesity, diabetes, heart and lung disease, kidney disease, we can have a graded increased risk of hospitalization and death. So over age 50 in general, the risks of hospitalization and death are over 1%. And that's typically a call to, that's enough to do something about it in order to prevent hospitalization and death. Below age 50 and then down to childhood is progressively less worrisome in terms of risk of hospitalization and death. So much so that I saw a small child with COVID-19 last weekend, you know, 2 or 3 year old, literally had a runny nose for a day and a half, and that was it. It's almost milder than the mildest cold. So it's incredibly age dependent in terms of its risks. Now, what determines the case fatality rate, the most important feature, is early treatment. So we can't say, well, this variant is more lethal than that variant, because it all depends on if the patient received treatment or not. So the virus itself, its lethality, if you will, cannot be singularly assigned without factoring in all these different factors. One of the things that listeners can do, they can go online and go to the Cleveland Clinic COVID-19 risk calculator, and with age and other features, one can actually estimate the risk of hospitalization or death.
And much of the treatment doesn't seem like there's any treatment. they'll say they got COVID, they take a test, and they just have to go and be at home for 2 weeks. I mean, that's really part of the issue, isn't it?
That's a big part of this interview and others. You know, treatment is strongly supported in the United States for those over age 50 with multiple medical problems with proven protocols. And they're supported by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, the Frontline Critical Care Consortium, American Frontline Doctors, and the Truth for Health Foundation. So there's 4 chartered organizations. AAPS has got state chapters. And they strongly support early treatment. Our government agencies, the FDA, CDC, NIH, and then other well-known medical societies, AMA, ACP, the Infectious Disease Society of America, they just don't address outpatient treatment. They have a singular focus on inpatient treatment. So the outpatient treatment societies support it. It is a standard of care. Millions of people have received early outpatient care to prevent hospitalization and death. And the converse is true, that the patients who get hospitalized or die, nearly all of them have received no early treatment, none. And so they go for weeks and weeks with no treatment, get progressively sick until they can't breathe anymore, and then they're hospitalized. And those cases are tragic. The vast majority, the studies, 2 good studies, one by Proctor, the other one by Zelenko, demonstrate that 85% of the hospitalizations and deaths are avoidable with early treatment.
And some of this early in treatment would include what? These drugs that we're hearing about that have been banned, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin?
Well, believe it or not, we lead off with use of monoclonal antibodies, which are amazingly effective. Former President Trump received them. Governor Abbott just received them. Celebrity Joe Rogan just received monoclonal antibodies. So individuals over age 50, certainly seniors over age 65, should lead off their outpatient treatment with a monoclonal antibody infusion. The current one available works very well is Regeneron. It's the combination of 2 separate fully humanized monoclonal antibodies. They're safe and effective. And when they're used earlier and earlier in the course of disease, even when things seem mild, they really head things off at the pass. Now, you can't bind up and take out all the virus of the system, because most of the virus is inside of cells, but it does great to bind up the circulating virus in the bloodstream. So we lead with monoclonal antibodies. We advise everybody go on a nutraceutical bundle, which includes zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, and a polyphenol supplement called quercetin or quercetin. Another very handy thing to use is to use famotidine or Pepcid. That's an over-the-counter antacid, but interestingly, it does block some of the activity of the virus in terms of how it recirculates inside cells. And so that's advised. It also has an antihistamine effect to it. And that's a wonderful, simple thing one can do over the counter. So the nutraceutical bundle, famotidine, that's all over the counter. The other thing that's over the counter is very useful is to get betadine or povidone iodine. That's the brown liquid that the hospitals use to sterilize wounds. You can buy a bottle of that on Amazon or at the pharmacy, and just put a few drops in a glass of juice glass of water. It'll turn the water brown. Swish it, gargle it, and spit it, as well as spray it up in the nose or use Q-tips up in the nose, and that markedly reduces the viral load in the body. That's supported by multiple studies done all over the world. Singapore really led the way there. In concept, is supported by the American Dental Association, which recommends that type of approach for other viruses. And it really zaps the virus in the nose and mouth. When people are sick with COVID-19, they're carrying a massive viral load. So at home, one would want to do that povidone iodine washes at least twice a day and nasal to reduce their infectivity to others. And so many healthcare workers use that povidone iodine as prevention. I know the dentists, I work with a very well-educated and instructive anti-infective dentist, Dr. Paul Gossett in Chicago. He really led the way on this. And he states that dentists in his circle use this themselves because they're in mouths all day long. And there have been no dental outbreaks in the United States because they use povidone iodine. If one is allergic to iodine, they can use dilute. And again, the key is very dilute. You don't need much of it. Hydrogen peroxide, very dilute sodium hypochlorite, which is a household bleach, just a few drops of household bleach in a glass of water, swish and spit. Do not swallow any of these. And then the least effective but still works is Listerine. No one can actually use Listerine twice a day, but it's hard to use in the nose. But so we recommend the nutraceutical bundle, oral nasal hygiene. I mentioned the monoclonal antibodies as the big therapy up front. And then after that, we use sequence multi-drug therapy. This is exactly what Joe Rogan received, and he was on the news telling everybody about it. We either use hydroxychloroquine, supported by 250 studies now, or ivermectin, supported by 61 studies, 31 randomized trials. So these are very well studied, very accepted drugs in combination with doxycycline or azithromycin. On day five or pulmonary symptoms, we use inhaled budesonide and oral prednisone. We use oral colchicine. We put all adults on aspirin, 325 milligrams a day as a mild blood thinner. Those with higher risk conditions or those with low oxygen saturations, that's a call for full dose anticoagulation with Lovenox or oral anticoagulants such as Eliquis or Rivaroxaban or Edoxaban. So we use what's called sequence multi-drug therapy. It takes a skilled doctor to do it, about 4 to 6 drugs. We have about 500 treating doctors in the United States, 4 national telemedicine services, 15 regional services. It's not enough to take care of the entire country. So we're trying to get other doctors trained and sufficiently skilled and confident to treat COVID-19 because we need to treat it at home. If it's not treated at home, there is zero chance to prevent a hospitalization. It's so important to start early treatment.
And as you've mentioned, this early treatment, much of it, as you've mentioned, is preventative to take some of the vitamins and so forth.
Right. So what I've covered is active early treatment. So someone's acutely ill with COVID-19, they have a positive PCR antigen test, and that's active treatment, what I just went through. And again, it's over age 50, multiple medical problems. Younger people, if they present with severe symptoms. So I commonly ask, what happens if we get an 8-year-old and they present with severe symptoms? I said, listen, children need to be treated too. Children should not be hospitalized with COVID-19. The only ones who get hospitalized are those who get no treatment. So how would a child who present, let's say a child with asthma who gets superimposed COVID-19 and they're presenting with severe symptoms, wheezing, coughing, really laboring, we would use inhaled budesonide. We can use oral hydroxychloroquine in a weight-based approach. We can use oral azithromycin. We can also use oral ivermectin, just as we would with scabies. A child has scabies, we would do the same thing. We would use oral prednisone and probably limited weight-based aspirin, probably for just about 5 days. We could get a child through that illness every time. If the child gets no treatment whatsoever, they could end up in the hospital, and that shouldn't happen. So children also need to be treated, but only if they present with severe symptoms. If a child simply has cold-like symptoms, we just let them get through it. Remember, everybody treated and gets through the illness, they get durable, permanent robust immunity. It's wonderful. The chances of ever getting a second infection are exceedingly small, and they do wonderful from that point forward.
Dr. Peter McCullough is my guest on Freedom Loves Company. We're just going through the basics here of COVID-19. Dr. McCullough has treated many patients with COVID-19 and is an expert here. Now, when you mentioned what these hospitals are treating, this isn't every hospital. Well, there's only very few. Is that right? That are actually treating
COVID-19. I mentioned about 500 treating doctors, the 4 telemedicine services, the 15 regional services. You know, a real popular one is called myfreedoctor.com. Another one is Speak with an MD. Another one is Frontline MDS. These telemedicine services are humming. They're working 24/7. But we need more treating doctors. So in every city, there's one or two or three treating doctors who is really skilled in doing this. But we just have millions of patients right now. Everyone's overwhelmed. In fact, I literally had to cut off talking to a patient before I jumped on. I told her, as soon as I get off this interview, I'm going to get back on. She's acutely sick with COVID-19. So we need more treating doctors to get the treatment going. Now, in terms of prophylaxis, what can somebody do to prevent COVID-19? So if they're well, if they're perfectly well and they want to prevent COVID-19, we would only suggest people who have high contact jobs over age 50. And there we can do the dilute povidone iodine or betadine, very dilute betadine, swish and spit and gargle twice a day, nasal spray twice a day as oral nasal hygiene. And then on selected cases, we'll use once a week hydroxychloroquine or twice a week ivermectin.
One of the things you mentioned in your previous answer was the PCR test. And I want to ask you about that because I am very suspicious of what the media is saying when they say all kinds of cases or people have taken a PCR test. And I've heard reports that these PCR tests are inaccurate in terms of the at so many cycles. Can you give us an overview of the PCR test question?
The nasal PCR, or polymerase chain reaction test, was the very first test put forward for COVID-19. And the methodology came out of the CDC. And it seeks to find little pieces of RNA, little pieces of genetic material of the virus that code for a different typical target, the one the CDC had to target, the polymerase. And what can happen is when that cycler is run excessively, it just keeps cycling through all the different material in the sample, it can be false positive. So what we've learned over time is the cycle thresholds shouldn't be more than 25. We used to run them at 35, 40, and it's cranking too hard and will basically pick up genetic material from a human cell or from another bacteria that's in the sample. So PCR thresholds should not exceed 25. That's a technical thing that the labs need to know. The other thing is that the PCR test is only approved and should only be utilized in acutely sick people. This is really important. We should never test, and it's never been approved to do so. The World Health Organization says don't do this. Don't test people as a matter of routine, like testing people to get on airplanes, crossing the border, in school, or in work. None of that is approved, and none of that is recommended by the World Health Organization. So anybody listening who's a decision maker, stop asymptomatic testing. All it does is crank false positives. And you're right, the case count right now in the United States probably can be cut by 40% if we just get rid of the false positives due to all the unnecessary testing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I noticed that when working with the local college, they seem to be testing them continuously, the students, and required testing. So
it should be dropped immediately. It's important. All they're doing is cranking false positives. They're wasting resources. In the United States, we've had about 45 million cases of COVID-19. We've actually burned resources for 400 million tests. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Testing doesn't get people cured. The virus doesn't transmit asymptomatically. So if you have two well people, there's no reason to test them. So the virus only transmits from sick person to susceptible person. The other issue with the PCR, and this came out recently, the CDC announces the original methodology of the PCR cannot distinguish between flu or influenza and COVID. So this is really important. Now, the methodologies, that was the first methodologies in the labs, and I'm not sure how many commercial labs still rely on some of the CDC steps in the assay. But the point is that big rise that we had in COVID-19 last year, it occurred concurrently with a dramatic reduction in influenza. It was said that influenza went away last year.
Right.
Well, it's probably not true. Influenza was probably there, there was invariably seniors who were very sick, and they had influenza, and they took a COVID test, and they were misdiagnosed as having COVID. So unfortunately, we'll probably never know the story, but there's probably a significant number of COVID cases that were actually inappropriately put in isolation. They were inappropriately given remdesivir and dexamethasone and other treatments in the hospital when in fact it was just a senior citizen with the flu.
Well, that's what I heard of a lot and a great deal in terms of even people who have died from COVID or with COVID. Those distinctions were not quite so clear either in terms of death certificates and whatnot.
Yeah, we know from the CDC webpage, and I think others agree with this, that 90% of the deaths attributed to COVID-19 have significant contributing other conditions. So it's certainly possible that someone could have been at the end of life with end-stage emphysema, and they died, and they were COVID positive, and it was labeled as a COVID death. So we recognize that. It's most dramatic, by the way, in children. Last year, there was roughly 300 children who died of COVID-19, and analyses have been done by Dr. Scott Jensen and Dr. Marjorie Makary. Both of them arrived at the same conclusion. Out of those 300 deaths, only one child was previously well, only one. So millions and millions and millions of children developed COVID-19, and they absolutely positively do well with fundamentally no risk of mortality.
I'm speaking with Dr. Peter McCullough from his home. We are discussing COVID-19. You mentioned that COVID-19, because this is big. You just said this. It seems this is big about the whole government program here, cannot be spread by people without symptoms. I mean, that's kind of the whole foundation for all of this effort, masking and distancing and everything, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fundamental. And we didn't know this at the beginning, so I don't fault anybody at the beginning for being excessively cautious. But seminal papers came out, one by Madewell, one by Cao, that showed in huge sample sizes that the virus cannot be spread when someone's asymptomatic. If someone actually happens to be positive and carrying the virus when they're asymptomatic, they're not spreading it. They're actually forming immunity and they're not communicable. How the virus spreads is when people have symptoms. When they have fever, nasal congestion, cough, stuffiness, runny nose, that's when they spread the virus. And that's no different than any other upper respiratory tract infection. So we don't have to go on a witch hunt. If people don't have symptoms, they don't have to wear masks. They don't have to undergo testing. If you put masks on two people that don't have the virus, it's impossible for the masks to have any benefit, right? It's just two well people looking at each other wearing masks. Having said that, what we really need is we need smart policies regarding sick people. And I think instead of having this giant debate on public masking, we need to get rid of that debate and that discussion and come up with an intelligent masking and sick kid protocol, which as follows. A sick child should never go to school, period. And we need flexible employment for mothers and fathers to stay home with the children, so sick children should never go to school. That's point number one. If a child at school gets sick, we need a policy where put a mask on that child, get them away from other children, and call the parents to pick them up and get them home. As a general rule, it takes about 3 hours of face-to-face contact to transmit the virus. So if we can get the child a mask on that child and get the child home away from the other kids, we can reduce spread. But it's absolutely ridiculous to not focus on sick kid policies and focus on well people wearing masks that a well person is no threat to another well person.
I mean, and that's a big deal. That is the huge thing that's going on of people, everyone being forced to wear a mask. I mean, since this whole thing began, it was a universal policy of everybody needs to be locked down, you know, but you're talking about which was logical common sense. It used to be before this was that you treat people who are sick or people who are at risk.
That's absolutely true. This idea of if we have a giant population of people who don't have the virus, it should make sense that locking them down will not help anything because they don't have the virus. You see, I think Everybody, common sense ought to prevail here. If nobody has the virus, then locking down people without the virus can't possibly influence anything. Having said that, if someone is sick with the virus, they need to be quarantined and they need to be quarantined and they need to be treated early at home and not leave the home. We get the medicines delivered to them. And even when we give a monoclonal antibody infusion, you know, we can have home infusion services do this. We can have them go to a treatment room in an ER through a separate entrance. We don't contaminate things. They give them an infusion and they go home. The antibody infusions are really first rate. And I think seniors really, and everybody listening to this should demand antibody infusions if they have severe symptoms or if they're senior citizens or at high risk. And then the rest of the treatments at home, and this is really important. We know untreated, the average person continues to shed and spread virus for 2 weeks. That's a long period of time. If we institute early sequenced multi-drug therapy, as I've published in the American Journal of Medicine and reviews in cardiovascular medicine in 2020, these are the most widely used protocols worldwide. These methods reduce the duration of shedding from 14 days to 4 days. So it's only early treatment that allows reduced spread of the infection, reduced hospitalization and death. It's very, very important. Every country has to have a pivot to early treatment. We saw it happen in Mexico City. They were getting absolutely slammed. They made an immediate pivot to ivermectin-based early treatment. They got themselves out of the jam. The same thing happened in Peru. India, that's where the outbreak of the Delta variant happened. They crushed their curves with early treatment. An American hero, Dr. Harpal Magnant, worked very extensively with the Indian governments in the states there, and they blasted away with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin-based protocols. They also gave monoclonal antibodies. They crushed their curve. The countries that absolutely refuse to get on the bandwagon with early treatment continue to punish their populations, including the United Kingdom, Israel, and others, and they're suffering miserably through the outbreak. In the United States, it's mixed. Fortunately, we have major societies. They're considered modern-day American heroes, treating patients early at home to avoid hospitalization and death. But our major government advisory agencies are not on board with early treatment. In fact, they don't even make it easy for monoclonal antibodies to be administered.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I want to diverge here just for a second and talk about your position and what you're saying as a doctor, and then what the government is saying through their governmental agencies. How did there get to be such a disconnect?
Well, I think the first thing is none of our government leaders could frame the problem originally. This is really important. We've been through two administrations now. No one in any position of authority in the U.S. government has made this statement that COVID-19 is a bad illness and it results in two poor outcomes, hospitalization and death. And I'm going to put together a team of doctors who are learning how to treat COVID-19, and I'm going to stop these hospitalizations and deaths. And if our president can't say that, our vice president, our White House task force, our NIH and CDC directors, if they can't actually state the problem and an action statement like that, they have zero chance of solving the problem. Zero. And it's amazing. To this day, we have not seen teams of doctors with expertise in treating COVID-19. Almost all the media doctors outside of myself and maybe a few of people on my team have even seen a COVID-19 patient, let alone treated one. So many doctors are on TV giving opinions, and they have never even seen COVID-19, and they've never treated a single patient. And I can tell you, our agency directors, they've never seen a case, and they certainly never treated a case. So how can they possibly have any credibility in treating COVID-19? They can't.
And yet, at the same time, there are doctors who are taking orders from the CDC, even over against what they might do in terms of treating people.
I think that's the wrong positioning for the following reasons. The CDC is not a treatment organization. The CDC is really a public service organization. Same thing with the National Institutes of Health. That's a research organization. And the FDA is a drug regulatory organization. None of them have any credentials or any standing with respect to treatment of patients. They don't have any fiduciary responsibility. They don't have any liability responsibility. They are here to serve the public. They're here to gather data, analyze data, and present it to us. The consumers of the CDC, NIH, and FDA are doctors and patients, but they serve us. The doctors and patients make the decision. That's called the fiduciary responsibility. So the fiduciary responsibility sits above and is in a superior position to FDA, CDC, and NIH recommendations. If a patient dies of COVID-19, it's not like we can say, oh, the CDC is at fault here, or the FDA. It's actually the doctors who is at fault. And it's the patient and families who are at fault that didn't seek early treatment. So the ball really rests with the doctors. And that fiduciary relationship is really important. You know, we took a Hippocratic oath. The Hippocratic oath says we use everything in the best of our ability to help patients. You know, we rarely cure problems, and we don't cure COVID-19. We're trying to help the patient through the illness. We try to help often, but we always care about patients. We always answer that phone. And what we never want to see is a doctor hang up on a patient and say they don't treat COVID-19. We never want to hear a doctor say that there's no treatments for COVID-19, because it's not true. In fact, we have treatment guides, and we have hundreds and hundreds of studies, and we have whole organizations dedicated to treating COVID-19. So it's not true that there's no treatment for COVID-19. So we don't want our public to be deceived. We don't want to create excessive fear. We want to welcome patients appropriately into early sequence multi-drug therapy.
And in some cases, some doctors have prescribed some of these treatments, and then their administrations have banned that. Is that the case too?
It's very unfortunate. Again, those administrations, they don't treat patients, mm-hmm. and those administrations don't have a fiduciary responsibility. So administrations and other bodies that are trying to put a chill on treatment, they're trying to discourage patients from being treated, and they're trying to discourage doctors and mid-level providers from treating patients. In my view, that's unethical, it's immoral, and from a civil perspective, it's illegal.
Dr. Peter McCullough, my guest on Freedom Loves Company. I want to step and move into vaccines right now. So this mass vaccination, here's the open-ended question. Is this mass vaccination program medically sound?
I was never on board with mass vaccination. I take care of older people with heart and lung disease. About 70% of my patients volunteered for the vaccine program in December, January, and February. I always thought seniors, nursing home workers, where we had clear outbreaks and spread, we had high mortality. I always thought 5, 10, maybe 15 million Americans getting the vaccine, and then an assessment on the vaccine, if it really works, and safety would have been appropriate. What's really happened with the vaccine program has been a runaway freight train, where it's clear now the vaccine has made the whole problem far more worse than has been helpful. And we have still yet to have a single press briefing or a single report from the CDC and FDA, who are the sponsors of the voluntary program. We've still yet to have a report from them on how the vaccines are doing. I mean, this is astonishing. We should have had reports weekly if we're going to have the biggest public program in the history of our country for a vaccine. There's been no report, none. It's 8 months into it, and they are dead silent on how the vaccines are doing. So patients have a ton of questions. For instance, what's the best vaccine? There's three vaccines in the United States. There must be a winner and there must be a loser. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks that they're the same. Nobody. And so, but our government has not been transparent on what's the best vaccine. Another question is, what's the safest vaccine? Which is a vaccine with the least amount of side effects? Or how can vaccines be safely administered? Again, no information, no press briefing, complete silence. And so Americans are really, really disturbed with our public agencies on this. Americans have seen advertisements. I went one past today, a billboard that says the vaccines are safe and effective. Well, that has to be proven. You know, those are statements that require proof. They're proof. Now, we had registrational trials last year, the FDA strictly excluding suspected COVID recovered, women of childbearing age, pregnancy, strictly excluding those. And with the legacy variants of COVID-19, the alpha, beta, and some gamma variants, that the vaccines were 90% effective. Now, they had an absolute risk reduction less than 1%, so we know they wouldn't influence COVID-19 in the population. But per individual, they could have been useful if someone would have come in contact with COVID-19, even though the rates of COVID-19 in both the vaccine and treatment groups are less than 1%. They could have been useful. But what we found out is by January 22nd, we had a situation in the United States. We only had 27 million Americans vaccinated. We already had 186 deaths that occurred after the vaccine. That was far in excess of the 150 deaths we would see with 278 million shots across 70 vaccines. So the COVID-19 vaccine should have been, with proper data safety monitoring, the vaccine program should have been shut down in February. And it just, the program has no critical event committee, no data safety monitoring board, and no human ethics committee. And these lack of safety safeguards, and the lack of transparency from the agencies is frankly alarming. We have never seen that in the history of our country. It violates every principle of ethical and legal research from the Office of Human Research Protections, from the Nuremberg Code, the Declaration of Helsinki. The public program is research. None of these products are FDA approved. Not even Pfizer was not FDA approved. A lot of people were misled by that announcement on August 23rd that this public program is research. And the consent form says it's research. It says it's a clinical investigation. The consent form hasn't been changed. And so we have a situation where the death rate started to climb. On two occasions, on March and June, the CDC and FDA have said, without really any other description, they've said none of the deaths are due to the vaccine, without telling us how the cases were reviewed. There's been no external review panels assigned. There has been no independent opinions rendered. So people have been frustrated now. So two papers, one by McLachlan, one by Rose, have gotten the data and they've analyzed it. And what they found is that 50% of these vaccine deaths occur within 48 hours, 80% at a week. We're now at 13,000 Americans and some people outside the United States who have died from the COVID-19 vaccines, 13,000. This sets all records for medicinal products and vaccines in terms of related mortality. And on top of that, and consistent with it, we've had over 200,000 Americans land in the hospital, ER, or office with a significant vaccine adverse events, and over 545,000 vaccine injuries certified by the CDC. So the CDC is racking up reports in what's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, where over 80% of the time, doctors and nurses are, you know, report to the system because they think the vaccine caused injuries. Even a recent internet survey shows that 12% of Americans know somebody in their circle or they know of somebody who has died due to the vaccine. So we're at a complete halt in terms of the vaccine program. People don't want it. We have about half the country took the vaccine, half the country didn't. The information on safety is known now, despite the government trying to block information to the public. And people are outraged. And so it keeps going and going. Now employers are mandating the vaccine on unwilling populations. The population knows that the vaccines aren't safe. And so we're really coming to a big standoff here in the fall.
Dr. Peter McCullough, my guest on Freedom Loves Company. In fact, in June of this year, you had said that 50,000 Americans, is that right, may have died because of the vaccines? Can you explain that figure?
Yeah, that was based on a multiplier that was coming out of the Center for Medicare Services. And there was a CMS whistleblower that worked with attorney Tom Rentz to file a public lawsuit against the government. And the number that came out from the extrapolation in June was 45,000 Americans, because the thought is not all the deaths are reported to the vaccine event reporting system. So in my circles, I know of deaths that have occurred after the vaccine, but because we couldn't find the vaccine cards, we couldn't report it to the adverse event reporting system. So the VAERS number of 13,000 is almost certainly an underestimate. And based on CMS data, that real number back in June was probably 45,000. Of course, now in September, it's much larger. So this is going to be more than 9/11. This is going to be more than most wars that Americans have been in. And the tension, you can cut it with a knife now, because we know COVID-19 itself can be fatal, but yet we know the vaccine itself can be fatal because the mechanisms are the same. The vaccines cause the body to produce the dangerous spike protein, which is the lethal part of the virus. So the vaccines are giving each person some exposure to a potentially lethal protein.
Is it true that, because the media, I follow the media, just the local TV, whatever, saying that the so-called unvaccinated are dying from COVID, as we hear reports in the news, or is a surge of cases and those dying perhaps, are those who have received a shot but are still classified as unvaccinated? I mean, is there a truth to that?
The current Delta wave that we're in, and the CDC as of August 28th now has 99.1% of all cases of COVID-19 in the United States being Delta. So for all intents and purposes, everybody with COVID-19 right now has Delta. The CDC has revealed some additional information to us. On July 26th, this is from their website, July 26th, the CDC had cases pushed forward to them from some departments of community health. So they don't have the universe of cases, but they have large numbers, and here they are, of vaccine failure. So they had, on July 26th, the CDC put on their website 6,587 cases of fully vaccinated vaccine failures in the hospital. And of those, 6,239 were hospitalizations, and 19% died, 1,263 died. I mean, that is a substantial number of, and the vast majority of deaths occur in the hospital. And then they updated a month later. So here are the data from August 23rd, 2021. I want you to get this interpreted here. We are at 11,000 cases. We have just under 20% of those who died. These are full vaccine failures who are hospitalized. People over age 65 accounted for 87% of the deaths, and they accounted for 70% of the hospitalizations. So this is CDC data from the U.S. Telling Americans that the vaccines are failing, and those being hospitalized have significant risk of death, actually higher risk of death than an average patient with COVID, and they tend to be seniors. These are the people we wanted to protect the most. What the CDC is not telling us is what vaccine did they take? Which one failed more? Was it Pfizer, Moderna, J&J? They're not telling us that. They're not telling us when did the person get vaccinated? Is the vaccine running out in terms of time? So very, very important information is being withheld from Americans trying to make decisions on vaccine, and doctors actually trying to interpret the data. But the CDC does publish, and there's a publication by Haver and colleagues, and that's from a limited number of hospitals that report into the CDC, and it's a more complete picture of what's going on. So Fiona Havers, and the title of the paper is COVID-19 Associated Hospitalizations Among Vaccinated and Unvaccinated Adults Over Age 18 from the COVID Network, January 1st to July 24th. So that's a big swath of data. And what they have found is they have found that, and I want to give you the exact number so we can make sure this talking point, they found that 23.4% of those hospitalized in June with COVID-19 were either partially vaccinated or fully vaccinated. So that gives you the proportion. So what this means is the talking point that was put out in June and July and partially into August, that this was a crisis of the unvaccinated, or right, that 99% of people in the hospital were unvaccinated, that talking point was simply false. And the CDC is now telling us in this publication that the false talking point. So false talking points are, by definition, that's a false information put out to the public by people in positions of authority. By definition, that's propaganda. And I think everyone should understand this, that 99.9% of those hospitalized are unvaccinated. That was a piece of propaganda. It wasn't true. It turns out that 76.6% were unvaccinated. Okay, fair enough. It's still the majority of unvaccinated that are being hospitalized. But the fully vaccinated are participating in the pandemic. And sadly, it's seniors where the vaccine is not holding up.
Well, isn't it also further than that, that it's, if you've had just one shot, you're still considered unvaccinated? Whereas obvious common sense would say, hey, he's got a shot. Maybe that has something to do with his adverse effect.
Well, yeah, they use the term fully vaccinated, which is fair enough, where you receive shot one, shot two, and then you have 2 weeks, and then you're considered fully vaccinated. Or with Johnson & Johnson, you receive the shot, and you have, I believe, 4 weeks, and you're fully vaccinated. Those are fair definitions. But if we go to other places that are ahead of us time-wise, we can see the vaccines completely failing. So in Israel, as an example, they were ahead of us. They were the darling of the vaccine world. Around March, April, they had almost no cases. They had everybody vaccinated who was eligible to get the vaccine as adults. Now in Israel, over 80% of people with COVID-19, those hospitalized, those that are dying, have been fully vaccinated. So Israel, the vaccines are completely failing. They've been now two months into a booster program. Now they're reporting booster failures. It's interesting, Israel uses the Pfizer vaccine, exclusively, which is the lowest dose vaccine. Pfizer uses 30 micrograms of messenger RNA, whereas Moderna, which is very similar, uses 100 micrograms per messenger RNA. So Pfizer's less than a third of the dose of Moderna. In a paper by Piranek and colleagues from Mayo Clinic, they estimate Pfizer has 42% protection. The Israeli Health Ministry estimates Pfizer at 39% protection, whereas Moderna in the Mayo Clinic data is estimated at 72% protection. So I think our government should come clean with us. If Pfizer is not covering it, but Moderna is doing a better job, they should give us the differential report on which vaccine is performing better. And for them not to do that and have the next American sign up and take Pfizer when it looks like Pfizer's losing and not covering the virus is a real tragedy. Why take on the risk of a vaccine for no benefit? A paper by Venkata Krishnan showed that the Pfizer antibodies just can't hit the Delta virus now. The antibodies just missed the mark. Remember, all the vaccines are coded against the wild type virus. That's long gone. That's extinct now. We're 99.1% Delta. And the vaccines, we have some data on the vaccines in Delta, but it's not very good. Pfizer looks like it can't cover it. We don't know about J&J. Moderna looks a little better.
Would you, as a personal physician, I mean, people are told, this is the first thing, get a free donut, get a vaccine. I mean, no distinguishing about what people might individually have. So you got that propaganda. But you as a doctor, on the other side, would you recommend any of these vaccines to anyone?
I take it as a case-by-case basis. Uh-huh. I said from the beginning I wasn't supportive of indiscriminate vaccination.
Right.
In fact, I published an op-ed to America last year, mid-2020, before the vaccines, and the title of the op-ed and published in The Hill was called The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. And I thought it was a gamble because the vaccines are all genetic vaccines. We've never used a genetic gene transfer technology to try to use as a vaccine. You know, the traditional is to use a killed virus, a live attenuated virus, or use a protein, but not to inject genetic material into human beings. This is for the first time doing gene transfer technology. And we have no idea how much genetic information is taken up in the body, how long it produces the dangerous spike proteins, probably at least 2 weeks or more. We're now finding out the lipid nanoparticles get up into the brain, they get into the heart, get into reproductive organs. The FDA has put out really strict warnings, gets into the heart and causes heart damage or myocarditis. So warnings against Pfizer or Moderna. J&J gets up into the brain, can cause paralysis, can cause blood clotting. I think Americans really ought to be looking at these FDA warnings. Our agencies are actually trying to talk to us. And what they're trying to tell us actually is the vaccines don't work and they're not safe. And they just can't come out and say it. In many ways, we'd be better off if they just came out and shut down the program and let us treat our way out of the epidemic.
Yeah. Absolutely. We just have about 2 minutes left, Dr. Peter McCullough, and I have probably many questions, but I want to give you a final word. Within these 2 minutes, what would you like to say to the American people of what they could say or do now?
The most important message at this point in time is for those who took the vaccine and they did fine with it, 168 million people, hope that they have some immunity. I'm starting to get a clinical sense that those who took the vaccine may have a milder course, which is wonderful. But don't get overconfident. If you've taken the vaccine and you get COVID-19, get a test and get early treatment. For those of you who haven't taken the vaccine, at this point in time, there's no reason to take on the risk of the vaccine. That, in fact, we can use early treatment protocols and prophylactic protocols, and we've gone over them very well on this interview, in order to prevent and treat COVID-19. And we should look forward to better vaccines in the future. The Novavax vaccine is a protein-based vaccine. It looked every bit as good as Pfizer and Moderna. Potentially, it can be adjusted to cover Delta. We should wait for better technology. But at this point in time, Pfizer, J&J, and Moderna look like they're not sufficiently safe, and they don't work well enough to mandate a vaccine or to take a vaccine at this point in time. It ought to be purely voluntary, medical freedom, case-by-case basis. Maybe a high-risk senior nursing home worker needs to have a vaccine. Okay, that's fine. But we should drop all vaccine mandates now. We should drop all public face mask policies now and start to adopt reasonable sick kid and sick person policies at work. We should adopt purely a optional nature to any form of vaccine, and then we absolutely positively need a national pivot to early treatment. We got 500 heroes trying to keep the whole country going. We got 1 million doctors on the sidelines, 500,000 nurse practitioners and PAs. They need to get in the game.
Awesome. Dr. Peter McCullough, thank you so much for your time today and for this expert analysis. Much appreciation to you and gratitude to you for the work that you do.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome to Freedom Love. So that was Dr. Peter McCullough, an interview that I recorded with him just a few hours ago and just played back here on Freedom Loves Company. What happens with this show is that this will be put on podcast, and you can go to my websites, johnshuck.com or progressivespirit.net, and you can download the podcast, play it. If you have a radio station, you can air it on your radio station as well. These get sent to the Pacifica Radio Network. Powerful interview there with Dr. Peter McCullough. I've had different kinds of viewpoints on this from different doctors, and I think it's important to have a wide variety of professionals talk about this from a variety of perspectives. And so I thought it was fascinating to hear what Dr. Peter McCullough had to say. And you can just look him up, and he has a lot to say on his radio show as well as in the articles that he writes about COVID and about the vaccines and the problems that they are bringing to us. John Shuck here, coming up next hour, radio rumination about our situation. So stay with us then. Freedom Loves Company airs on Sunday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain Time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and midnight to 2 a.m. GMT. So make sure you mark that down and find us every week here on Revolution.radio. And please, when you do visit the website of Revolution.radio or freedomslips.com, please be generous. This is all, of course, voluntary and listener-supported radio that is uncensored. And so that is another critically important thing, uncensored conversation. All right, till next hour, be well.
Unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That's right.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
This is Freedom Loves Company, and this is the second hour of a two-hour show every Sunday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and midnight to 2 a.m. GMT. You can catch Freedom Loves Company. I'm John Shuck, and my website is johnshuck.com or progressivespirit.net. And those two websites, basically the same content, but they will get you access to the podcasts after they air. And then they're sent to radio stations. And if you're a radio station, you can pick it up. And it's radio ready every week. What a great show last hour with Dr. Peter McCullough. Talking about the various treatments, talking about the vaxes, talking about the COVID, the whole thing. Catch that. Certainly, I'll have that up on podcast in a day or two. All right. So I want to make sure you catch that interview that I had with Dr. Peter McCullough. I have a couple of things to talk about this hour. But first, I want to share with you from the Dhammapada. This is a new translation of the Buddhist classic by Gil Fronsdal. This is like one of the most read Buddhist scriptures, enjoyed by Buddhists and non-Buddhists alike. And the section that I'm going to begin with, I'm going to read two sections today. And this first one is called Evil. And so here it is. Be quick to do good. Restrain your mind from evil. When one is slow to make merit, one's mind delights in evil. having done something evil, don't repeat it. Don't wish for it. Evil piled up brings suffering. Having done something meritorious, repeat it. Wish for it. Merit piled up brings happiness. Even an evildoer may see benefit as long as the evil has yet to mature. But when the evil has matured, the evildoer will meet with misfortune. A doer of good may meet evil fortune as long as the good has yet to mature. But when the good has matured, the doer of good will meet with good fortune. Don't disregard evil, thinking, it won't come back to me. With dripping drops of water, even a water jug is filled. Little by little, a fool is filled with evil. Don't disregard merit, thinking, it won't come back to me. With dripping drops of water, even a water jug is filled. Little by little, a sage is filled with merit. As a merchant carrying great wealth in a small caravan avoids a dangerous road, as someone who loves life avoids poison, so should you avoid evil deeds. A hand that has no wounds can carry poison. Poison does not enter without a wound. There are no evil consequences for one who does no evil. Like fine dust thrown against the wind, evil comes back to the fool who harms a person who is innocent, pure, and unblemished. Some are reborn in a womb. Evildoers are reborn in hell. People of good conduct go to heaven. Those without toxins are fully released in nirvana. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, not in the ocean, not inside a mountain cave, where you will be free from your evil karma. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, not in the ocean, not inside a mountain cave, where death will not overtake you. Wisdom there from the Dhammapada. This is Freedom Loves Company. I'm John Shuck. So, how does this end? Does it end? And what is it exactly? A certain truth is that we are being massively deceived. And I refer you to my episode entitled Gaslighting for what I think is the psychological operation that is attacking us. None of this is real. The question has to do with whether the various authorities imposing masks and lockdowns based on questionable data and even more questionable authority are acting from incompetence, fear, bribery, or evil. This attack appears to have been planned for a long time. Certainly, the planners are operating from evil intent. The various mid-level demiurges that include presidents, members of Congress, governors, hospital administrators, college presidents, media CEOs, church bureaucrats, and other institutional stooges are obviously incompetent. But are they worse? Probably. They're likely fearful for their own little scabby skins and probably bribed to lie to people and enforce horrible diktats because they receive government funds, the COVID money, for doing so. They all pretend to follow the science and to mock and actively censor and silence anyone who challenges their authority. It is also likely that many, if not most, of these demiurges really believe the nonsense they're peddling and enforcing, as you can't fake it forever. So, to save your mind from the cognitive dissonance, you believe the lies and attack anyone who challenges the liars. None of these demiurges, or regular people for that matter, who brag on their Facebook profiles that they have been injected with dubious ingredients and strongly suggest you do the same, will be able to have their minds changed. It's gone too far. Their minds have been pickled, and you cannot unpickle a vegetable. They cannot be changed. They can only be stopped from doing harm to others, and that will be done only when more and more people tell what is true. We are no longer trying to awaken the sheep. We are rousing the lions, and the lions need rousing. In the scriptures, God needs rousing, and that's why the psalmists and the prophets would cry out to God to awake from slumber. We need to wake God up and wake the angels up. It sounds weird, but it's in the Bible. Cry out to God. Wake up. God will hear. Wonderful paragraph along that theme from the late Walter Wink, who was a biblical scholar. I remember going to a conference with him, and we at one point we yelled the Lord's Prayer at the top of our lungs. Your kingdom come, your will be done. And he had a beautiful passage in his book, Engaging the Powers, about waking God up. That's our task. And God kind of gets out of bed and rubs the sleep from his eyes and wanders around. And then suddenly our job is just simply to follow wherever God goes. Kind of a neat image, the idea of it's the lions, it's the gods, it's the angels, it's the powers of good that need to be awakened. It's not the sheep. It's not the people who have just totally rolled over and actually have taken up the banner for these oligarchs and this massive chaos, this plandemic. No, it's not them that need the waking. It's actually the sleeping warriors. They're waiting. They're waiting to be awakened. When it's loud enough, when the people get loud enough, when the people insist enough, when they begin to believe that goodness has agency and call for it and ask for it and plead for it and pray for it, then the lion awakes. Then God awakens. So we are rousing the lions, the angels, and God to move from neutrality or from silence or from inaction to hearing the cries, picking a side, speaking out, and acting out. And this will not end well if we do not defeat it. In regards to the needle, this is at the very least a marketing campaign for the pharmaceutical companies who are making, I don't know how much money they make, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, perhaps at some point even trillions of dollars selling their product. It's not free, by the way, this product. And despite the fact that the junkies inject themselves and get a free donut for doing so, the free candy is not free forever. And one injection is not enough. You need more injections. And it appears booster shots on a regular basis. In Israel, they're pushing the fourth one now. The fourth injection. The pharmaceutical companies are getting paid for every shot. It's our government money that's paying for it. And now, as the vax papers have come out, or the vax app on your phone that you shouldn't get, that allows you to participate in life, these shots will then become valuable and they will have a price tag on them. And you will need updated vax papers every several months or whatever these demiurges require, and they won't be free. You'll be paying for the boosters so that you can be fully up to date with your shots, just like an animal, and thus be able to go to the movies or go to the store or go to the ball game or the airplane or work or whatever. And life is going to be very difficult for you without the pass and the ongoing shots required to keep your pass up to date. That is, unless we stop this. This is happening. It's happening already. Stores in San Francisco and New York, and you can't go to see a Trailblazers game in Portland. You can't do stuff without your pass, which is just incredible to think this is actually happening, but it is happening. More and more people, as life gets harder, will think they are making it easy on themselves by getting the injection. Oh, I might as well just do it. Thinking they are getting it over with. And that is a very costly deception. It's never over. Slavery does not end, and this is slavery. You don't give up rights to get them back faster. They're gone forever. Hopefully, those who get one shot or got one shot so they could fly or whatever will realize that one shot is not enough. We'll stop there. I think some people will stop after the one, regretting that they did it. Sadly, many people will keep getting injected just to keep up to date, not even for their health, but just for permission to live life. They've traded their inherent rights for a permission slip. It's not a good trade. There are many, many people, likely far more than the media is telling us, who have not and who will not be injected. And they will be the ones who will lead in this new age to come. The injected will suffer and be slaves before anything even happens to their bodies. They've already been enslaved in mind because they sold their bodies for convenience. The ingredients from the injections will kick in due time. Now, I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that these injections are simply what they say they are. I don't know. I have no idea. But in time, we will know. Now, we should say something about the media reports that the unvaccinated are getting sick, filling the hospitals, and dying. This is easily shown to be deception. Tessa Lena, in a recent article, showed how. Her column is entitled, "What Does the Word Unvaxxed Mean?" And she writes, and I'm quoting her from her article, Tessa Lena, quote, "According to the CDC, a person within the first 14 days of the first dose of a two-dose vaccine or the first dose of the one-dose vaccine is considered unvaxxed. Same is true for anyone whose status is not available," end quote. So let's stop right there. The people that the hospital administration and media are calling unvaxxed include those who have been injected. Just to be clear again, the people that the hospital administration and media are calling unvaxxed include those who have been injected. They're not unvaxxed in any normal or real definition of the word. We don't know how many people fit under that new Orwellian definition. But back to Tessa Lena, quote, "Anecdotally," this is Tessa Lena talking, "I know a number of people who experienced COVID-like symptoms shortly after receiving the shot. Following the logic of the CDC's definition, if they were to go to the hospital and test positive using a PCR test, which in itself is a work of art, well then, there we go. Another unvaccinated COVID patient to add to the list." Let me quote the CDC directly. "Persons were considered fully vaccinated 14 days after receipt of the second dose in a two-dose series, Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna COVID-19 vaccines, or they were considered fully vaccinated after one dose of the single-dose Janssen and Johnson COVID-19 vaccine, partially vaccinated 14 days after receipt of the first dose, and less than 14 days after the second dose in a two-dose series, and unvaccinated 14 days of the receipt of the first dose of a two-dose series, or one dose of the single-dose vaccine, or if no vaccination registry data were available. This is the CDC's language. Tessalita says, is this good science? I mean, to me, she's saying, this is a bit like changing the definition of murder in the middle of a murder trial from killing a person to killing a person or possibly insulting the person's mother, then formally indicting the suspect for murder based on a possible rude remark and burying the new definition of murder in some obscure legal document that no normal person would ever look for, all the while publishing a large number of eloquent articles in very popular newspapers about how the suspect was proven guilty of murder and officially indicted. That doesn't feel right, she says. Now, let's do an exercise. Tessalina, still reading still from her article. Her article, what does the word unvaccinated mean? She says, let's do an exercise and think about statistics in childlike terms. How many people ended up in the hospital with COVID-like symptoms shortly after receiving their first dose of a two-dose vaccine or their one dose of a one-dose vaccine? We don't know. Was it a lot of people or just a handful of people? We don't know. Among the hospitalized COVID patients who have contributed to the epidemic of the unvaxxed, have there been more proper people or pseudo under 14 days people? We don't know. And what is a COVID patient anyway? Is it strictly a person who came to the hospital due to COVID-like symptoms? Or is it also a person who has broken a leg and had a positive PCR test on admission? We don't know. How many cycles did they use for the PCR test? We don't know. Did the hospitals give a PCR test to all patients, regardless of their assumed vaccination status, or mostly just the unvaxxed patients? We don't know. And finally, did the hospitals properly report all the breakthrough cases? Allegedly not. End quote. Tessalina from her good article, what does the word unvaccinated mean? The takeaway from that for me was that when the media is reporting that the unvaccinated are filling up the hospitals, and if you're not vaccinated and you shouldn't go to the hospital, you should just go die, you know, right? I mean, we're getting this hardcore language. It's the unvaccinated that are the people who are getting sick and dying. And the question is that no, that isn't the case. And part of that is this fudging with definitions of words, calling unvaccinated people who actually have had an injection. Yeah. Anyway, Tessalina from her recent essay, what does the word unvaccinated mean? I recommend Tessalina. She was a guest on my show a few weeks ago. She writes a lot of very important stuff. So whenever we see a headline that says how many cases there are or hospitalizations or deaths due to the COVID upon the unvaccinated, know that that is a deception on a massive scale. We have no idea whether or not any of these people took the needle and still are called unvaccinated. Nothing can be believed. It is very possible that those who are suffering in the hospital or who have died have had at least one needle filled with special sauce injected into them. And this is simply common sense. Those who take experimental drugs or even tried and true drugs may suffer side effects. We're not sick. We're not contagious. But we've been told that we are. And that doesn't mean that there isn't sickness. doesn't mean that it's not, you know, that you can't get something, even COVID. I'm not saying that COVID doesn't exist. I mean, I don't know. It seems to me, when I'm hearing Dr. McCullough talk last hour, yeah, COVID's a real thing. But not everybody has it. And not everybody should be treated as though they have it. That's not a healthy way to treat sickness. And we need to own that. We need to say, we're not sick. We're not contagious. And if we get sick, then we'll stay home. How simple is that? The people who tell us these things, that is the news, right? Mainstream media, have long track records of lying. They include the mainstream media, who is still lying to us about 9/11 and Afghanistan, for starters. So back to my original question. How does this end? Well, it won't end quickly. We'll be in this game created by the billionaires for years to come, until they defeat us, or until we defeat them. This does not end by giving in and hoping it gets better. The more rights are taken from people, the more the censorship, the more the propaganda, the longer it lasts, and the worse it gets. You don't stop bullies by giving in to them. You only stop them when they, that is, the bullies, realize that you are more trouble than you're worth. And you show that you're more trouble by not complying. There are many ways not to comply. Everyone, if he or she wishes to avoid slavery, must find a way not to comply. And in the midst of this so-called pandemic, there are other things that are happening to us. We are in the midst of a huge economic contraction. We can expect, I think, higher and higher prices, fewer and fewer products, including food, and more austerity. This pandemic, I see, in part, at least as a cover for this economic contraction or implosion. It's certainly a way for the parasites who have taken control of our governments to control the populations. Some places and people will be easier to control than others. Australia, what's it going through? My goodness. And you don't hear the news of actual resistance happening there with the truckies, the truckers, you know, going on strike and stopping things. There are positive things that are happening. People are resisting in many, many ways that are simply not being reported on. Some places will be easier to control than others. You want to make sure you're not an easy one, an easy mark. We need to be difficult to control. A bright spot is that more and more people are not happy with these vaccination mandates and with all the other nonsense. They're not happy with the masks. They're not happy with the constant media bombardment. At what point does not being happy result in actual change? I don't know. But it does lead to the question of what next. When the pandemic becomes not credible to a significant number of people, then we would likely expect something else to take its place. And the goal, as I see it and have said it since March of 2020, is complete control and ultimately reduction of the population. I've seen no reason to change that prediction. Control, first through psychology, through authoritarianism, through people accepting and rationalizing the loss of their own inherent rights. And then the population is at the mercy of those who wish to control things. And there is no end to this. We will be subject to one crisis after another. Each crisis will be designed to make us fearful and to seek authoritarian answers to our problems. It is a pandemic today, a series of natural disasters tomorrow, climate change the next day, an internet shutdown after that, an alien attack, why not? More scary diseases, and through each of these crises, increasing surveillance is an automatic, increasing government control, increasing censorship, and increasing propaganda can all be expected. And ultimately, it looks like we're on the verge of a world war with China and the U.S. and all the other powers fighting for resources. And we need to insist on transparency everywhere. We need to insist on our right to speak and our right to gather the information we need, and we just need to exercise it even when, you know, it's restricted. You just got to keep doing it. We're in a long emergency. We're in the midst of civilizational change, and it is going to take some time. We should take note that this is the long game, and much of life may carry on as it can for some time, but we are in for change. And so I think it's important that we find ways to not always be in panic mode, that we find ways to be joyful, that we find ways to be happy, that we find ways to be spiritually connected, that we find ways to love each other, that we find simple things to do. My lovely and I just finished canning tomatoes today. That's the kind of thing that we just got to keep doing, you know, happy things, because this is a long thing. And part of the goal is to take our joy from us, to take our spirituality away from us, to take our happiness, to take our love, to take what matters most to us not have us focus on it. And so I think it's incredibly important for us spiritually, emotionally, interpersonally, to continue more than ever to try to be happy, even in the midst of all of this, especially in the midst of all of this, to find things that bring you joy, that bring you peace, that bring you love, and that allow you to express that to others. I think nothing is more important than being a helpful person, than being, you know, happy, peaceful, positive. It doesn't mean what we think it means. It doesn't mean the Pollyanna. It doesn't mean ignoring it. It means this is the long game. And part of what is going to make the human experiment a positive experiment is that if we don't lose our humanity in the midst of this attack by evil, and I do say it is an attack by evil. This is a spiritual attack. It is fast. It is filled with symbolism. I haven't even gone into that much, but it is completely filled with symbolism, which gives it away, in my opinion, that this is really a spiritual attack from outside forces on the human being, on us as human beings. And the same resistance is the same resistance as ever, is the resistance of pure love and pure goodness and pure truth. Fear is what's driving this. And the opposite of fear is love. And so we need to do what we can to keep happy, to keep loving, and to keep joyful. I want to read to you again from the Dhammapada. It's a Buddhist classic. And this is called Happiness, Chapter 15, Happiness. Ah, so happily we live without hate among those with hate. Among people who hate, we live without hate. Ah, so happily we live without misery among those in misery. Among people in misery, we live without misery. Ah, so happily we live without ambition among those with ambition. Among people who are ambitious, we live without ambition. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments We shall feast on joy, as do the radiant gods. Victory gives birth to hate. The defeated sleep in anguish, giving up both victory and defeat. Those who have attained peace sleep happily. There is no fire like lust, no misfortune like hate, no suffering like the aggregates, and no happiness higher than peace. Hunger is the foremost illness. Sankaras, the foremost suffering. For one who knows this as it really is, nirvana is the foremost happiness. Health is the foremost possession, contentment the foremost wealth, trust the foremost kinship, and nirvana the foremost happiness. Tasting the flavor of solitude and peace, one becomes free of distress and evil, drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. It's good to see the noble ones. Their company is always a delight. Free from the sight of fools, one would constantly be happy. One who keeps company with fools will grieve for a long time. Living with fools is painful, as is living with foes. Living with the wise is delightful, like relatives gathered together. Therefore, you should follow a good, intelligent person who is wise, insightful, learned, committed to virtue, dutiful and noble, as the moon follows the path of the stars. That's a reading from the Dhammapada, chapter 15, called Happiness. This is Freedom Loves Company. Freedom Loves Company is on every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. Mountain Time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and midnight to 2 a.m. GMT. My name is John Shuck. My website is johnshuck.com or progressivespirit.net. I want to read to you another piece here. This is from Eva Corrine Bartlett. And so she's writing this. I found this via social media. It's on RT. It's called Media Fear. These are Eva Bartlett's thoughts. Wrote this August 29th. Over the past year and a half, hysterical media reporting on matters COVID-19 has reduced some people to a fearful state of unquestioning compliance, including a great number of otherwise critically thinking journalists. With screaming headlines in bold and large font, such as "Will this nightmare ever end?" and "Mutant virus skyrockets," and "Fear grows across the country, virus panic," and "Coronavirus horror." Social media footage shows infected Wuhan residents act like zombies. Is it no wonder many people are in a state of panic? In times when many are suffering mentally and physically under unnecessary and prolonged lockdowns, the incessant fear porn is causing excessive anxiety, which in turn will affect the health and mental well-being of some, if not many. In government documents from the UK's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE, dated from March 2020, advice was given saying, quote, "The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent using hard-hitting emotional messaging. This could potentially be done by trained community support volunteers, by targeted media campaigns, social media," end quote. I'd say the UK media campaign certainly did the job, and other Western nations got similar directives. The UK government also became the nation's biggest advertiser in 2020. Make what you will of the potential ramifications that could have on cash-strapped newspapers and their supposed independence. Having myself been deeply focused on exposing war propaganda and other media lies around Syria, Palestine, Venezuela, and elsewhere over the years, my default position has become one of deep cynicism on mass media reporting. A study by Swiss Propaganda Research noted, most of the international news coverage in Western media is provided by only three global news agencies based in New York, London, and Paris. Those agencies are AP, Reuters, and AFP. SPR notes, quote, the key role played by these agencies means Western media often report on the same topics, even using the same wording. In addition, governments, military, and intelligence services use these global news agencies as multipliers to spread their messages around the world. I'm reading here from Eva Bartlett, independent journalist. She goes on to say, given all this, I've come to believe that with regard to media reporting on COVID-19, my cynicism is well-deserved. COVID-19 reporting has increasingly been utterly absurd. With stories of people dropping dead in the streets, ice rink morgues to cope with the mountains of bodies, footage of an overcrowded New York hospital that just happened to be of an Italian hospital, claims of animals testing positive for SARS-CoV-2, and more recently, reports of people dying post-jab, but we are told it could have been much worse. When months into the outbreak, it became apparent that SARS-CoV-2 was far less lethal than first predicted. The media and talking heads moved from talking about COVID deaths to positive cases. Although relatively early on, a goat and a pawpaw tested positive for COVID-19, instead of then scrutinizing the accuracy of the PCR test as a means of detecting COVID-19, the media continued to hype the rise in COVID cases. In lockstep, COVID testing was increased dramatically using the PCR test recently revoked by the CDC. This inevitably pumped up the number of cases, which mass media have in turn promoted nonstop. This in turn gave ammunition to those enforcing lockdowns and vaccines. By now, hundreds of vocal doctors, nurses, virologists, immunologists, and other professionals actually worth listening to, whose data and experience counter the hype pumped out in media, have very quickly disappeared from social media, or otherwise deemed quacks and are thus largely silenced. This leaves the general public mainly getting their information via hyped-up media. Alongside this, there have been relentless ad hominem attacks on journalists who pose legitimate questions and uncomfortable truths about the official narratives around COVID-19. For offering perspectives which contradict the standard narratives around COVID-19, journalists have been deemed conspiracy theorists, pandemic deniers, right-wingers, selfish. I'm sure I've missed quite a few slurs. When it comes to matters COVID-19, it is suddenly unacceptable to question the science, question the authorities, or question the same media that sold us WMDs in Iraq and chemical attacks in Syria. Media are the drivers of COVID hysteria, and it is the daily bombardment of fear porn that confuses average people and enables tyrannical powers to be brought in largely unchallenged. As it is the responsibility of journalists to expose lies around wars of aggression, it is also the duty of journalists to do so around COVID-19. For some journalists who have stubbornly refused to hold power to account, instead towing the line on all things COVID, it appears their fear is of losing an audience and not of a virus. Whether or not you agree with dissenting voices, questions, or criticisms, we have the right to ask and make them. We do so knowing that remaining silent in the face of the brutal COVID measures is a guaranteed path to tyranny. And that is Eva Bartlett, a Canadian independent journalist and activist. She spent years on the ground covering conflict zones in the Middle East, especially Syria and Palestine. And she wrote that as called in RT, called "The Media's Addiction to COVID-19 Fear Porn is Perpetuating an Ever Worsening Cycle of Societal Damage Across the World." Eva Bartlett, one of the good ones, one of the journalists that is exposing lies for what they are, whether they're in Syria or Venezuela or Palestine or in Canada or in the United States. So that's what I was been thinking about all of this week. How does this end? How does this dystopia end? This strangeness, this craziness end? And I don't know if it does end. I mean, I think it's a symptom of civilizational change. I just didn't think this would be the way it happened. We knew we were hitting our limits. We knew things were coming. But we didn't know how well planned they would be by the oligarchs to, first of all, control us. And that's really at the end of the day, you have to understand, I think, that this is the case, that this pandemic, it could have been a number of things. It could have been probably several things out of a hat. But they pulled this one out and used it to control us in many ways, not only just in terms of, well, you can't be able to assemble, you can't protest, you have to wear this diaper on your face. You have to get these vaccines. They have to be mandatory, all of this kind of stuff, all of that kind of control, but also the symbolism of it all. The symbolism of the mask, for example. What is that? It covers up your face. It's a muzzle. It keeps you from seeing others. It keeps you from reading expressions. It has all kinds of bizarre ritualistic aspects to it, you know, when you can take it off, how you can remove it, how you can move it down to take a bite to eat, then you put it back up, you know, that kind of stuff, or sitting down versus standing up. And the mask, and especially with children, is really creating heavy psychological damage, anxiety levels are rising. People are anxious. People are afraid. And all of this masking. And when you see somebody with a mask, it just reinforces, oh my gosh, we need to be afraid. We need to be scared of this thing. We need to be scared. We need to mask ourselves up, mask everybody else up. And then these shots, oh my gosh. And the division that is causing. You know, it makes absolutely no sense medically at all to have a vaccine passport. I mean, either they work or they don't work. And just the constant lies. And so I think people are waking up. I mean, I just start hearing people talking more about it. In my local area, you know, you just talk to people and there many, many people are not complying. And when they want to inject the students, when they want to inject college students, and they want to force them and browbeat them into taking these injections because, well, if they're in sports, they'll be able to, you know, play more. If they take the injection, they will have less days off for the, you know, all kinds of coercion and given by people who know better, people in authority in these schools. And we have to speak up against that in every way we can and say, no, you can't force people to take a medical intervention, especially a student. I mean, they're adults, 18, 19, but they're still kids, really. And they have no medical risk. From the CDC itself. It's just insane what's happening. And I think we can't roll over out of fear and just say, oh, this is just all happening, I'm going to go hide from it. We can't do that. And we can't be so obsessed with it that we are not helpful. I mean, we have to be joyful. We have to be peaceful. We have to be loving. We have to be our human selves. We have to continue to do that. We have to do whatever it is we need to do, spiritually, physically, and emotionally, to keep our head above water, to keep our wits about us, to keep our love intact. And then, and we also have to know that this is bigger than us. We don't really know what's going on. I mean, I don't at least. And I know everybody, you know, everybody has a theory and everybody has an idea, and I have several, you know, I entertain many, but I don't know really what is going on. Because it feels wrong. It feels to me spiritually evil. That's what it feels like. It feels like an attack by whatever forces there are in the universe over against other ones. And I don't know. I mean, you can go to through the religion and mythology and wherever you need to go to find information about that, but that's what it feels like. It feels like we are being deceived, and there's an intelligence about it, an intelligence and agency in regards to this deception and to who's working this deception. And so I find it important to be spiritually grounded in the goodness and in truth and in courage, and to not cave into the bullies. I mean, that's the biggest thing right there. These bullies are bullying our students. They're bullying our children. Bullying people who are vulnerable. And we need to stand up for each other. We need to stand up for them. We need to stand up for you. We need to stand up for me. We need to stand up for each other against all of this bullying type of behavior, all of this gaslighting type of behavior, all of this nonsense. It is what it is. But here's another thing. And again, I end it right here. I'll end it with this. We came into this world, I believe, knowing what we were going to face. I mean, before we were born, somehow, I believe our spirits were consulted. And therefore, we're chosen for this. We are the ones who are needed at this time. A couple of friends of mine, you know, saying they had anxiety, and I'm saying, you know, we need to take care of ourselves because we're needed. And we are needed at this time, and we're needed to be whole. We're needed to be filled with love and peace and joy and happiness. And we need to have our vibration positive. And we need to keep doing that as difficult as it is. And it is very difficult. And we don't know what our future is going to be. And all of that brings all of that kind of stuff, all of that anxiety. But We can't let that fear grab a hold of us and take a hold of us. There is danger, and we will deal with that by being human, by living with the most positive aspects of our humanity right up front. And that's what we have to do. And we have to stick up for the underdog. We have to stick up for the people who are getting hurt. We have to take risks. We have to take risks. You know, because it's when you stick up for somebody who's being bullied by an authority, you know, you might lose too. That's right. But what would you lose if you didn't? When we don't stick up for people, that's what we have to do. We have to stick up for what is right. And there are good people and there are right people. My previous hour's guest, Dr. Peter McCullough, he's a good one, you know. And regardless of whatever we all think about the intricacies of this virus, know that this is all about a deception, about confusing us. We have to find those people who really are doing the work of goodness, who are doing that, and emulate them and connect with them. And it's happening, because this could be a real positive thing for humanity. Positive when human beings find their true selves and their courage and their joy and their love. This is Freedom Loves Company. Be well.
Junkie, I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. And that's it. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Number one listener supported radio, the printing press for freedom at a time when freedom is needed the most.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is